She did care, but that little act of cruelty was her armour against the infectious pain of others. She had to wall off her heart or risk doing more harm. After a few weeks, it seemed she had mastered her feelings. Then late one night, there was a tap at her bedroom window. Pulling back the shade, she saw a young man standing in the moonlit grass. She had turned him away earlier that same day. "Didn't I tell you to go away?" she said, through the cracked window.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but I'm desperate. If you can help me, perhaps you might know of someone else who can take away my nightmares. I'm afraid they will drive me mad."
She had hardly looked at the young man when she'd sent him away earlier, but there was something in his expression now that made her gaze linger. He had a gentle face and kind, soft eyes, but his clothes were dirty and his hair askew, as if he'd narrowly survived some trauma. Though the night was warm and dry, he was shaking. She knew she should have closed her shades and sent him away again. Against her better judgment, she listened as the young man detailed the terrors that tormented his sleep. Devils and monsters, succubi and incubi, scenes conjured straight from hell. Just hearing about them gave Lavinia the shivers, and she was not someone who got the shivers easily. Yet she was not tempted to help him. She wanted no more troublesome nightmare thread, and so she told him that, as sorry as it made her, she couldn't help him.
"Go home," she said. "It's late. Your parents will worry."
The young man burst into tears.
"No, they won't," he wept.
"Why not?" she asked, though she knew she shouldn't have. "Are they cruel? Do they mistreat you?"
"No," he said. "They're dead."
"Dead?" Lavinia said.
Her own mother had died of scarlet fever when Lavinia was young, and it had been very hard. But to lose both parents, she could feel a gap widening in her armour.
"Perhaps I could bear it if they had died a peaceful death, but they did not," said the young man. "They were killed, murdered, right before my eyes. That's where all my terrible dreams came from."
Lavinia knew then that she was going to help him. If she had been born with this talent in order to free just one person from their nightmares, she thought, it had to be this young man. If that meant Baxter would become too large to hide, well, then she would just have to show Baxter to her father and admit what she had done. He would understand, she thought, when he heard the young man's story. She invited him inside, laid him on her bed, and reeled out amazing lengths of black thread from his ear. He had more nightmares clogging his brain than anyone she'd treated, and when she'd finished, thread covered her floor in a wide, squirming mat. The young man thanked her, flashed a strange smile, and slipped out her window so quickly he tore his shirt on the jamb. An hour later, Lavinia was still puzzling over that smile when dawn broke. The new thread hadn't finished coalescing into ball form, and Baxter, who seemed frightened of it, cowered in her pocket. Her father called the children to breakfast. Lavinia realized she wasn't quite ready to tell him what she'd done. It had been a long night, and she needed something to eat first. She swept the thread under her bed. She closed her bedroom door, locked it behind her, and went downstairs. Her father was sitting at the table, engrossed in the newspaper.
"Awful," he muttered, shaking his head.
"What is it?"
Lavinia asked.
He laid the paper down. "It's so depraved, I hesitate even to tell you. But it happened not far from here, and I suppose you'll hear about it one way or another. A few weeks ago, a man and his wife were murdered in cold blood."
So the young man had been telling the truth.
"Yes, I heard,"
Lavinia said.
"Well, that's not the worst part," said her father. "It seems the police have finally identified their chief suspect, the couple's adopted son. They're hunting him now."
Lavinia felt her head go light.
"What did you say?"
"See for yourself."
Her father pushed the paper toward her across the table. Above the fold was a grainy likeness of the young man who had been in her room only hours earlier.
Lavinia fell heavily into a chair and clung to the edge of the table as the room began to spin.
"Are you feeling all right?" asked her father.
Before she could answer, there came a loud bang from the direction of her bedroom. The new nightmare ball had finished forming, and now it wanted to be near her.
Thud! Thud! "Douglas, are you playing tricks?" her father called out.
"I'm here," said Douglas, wandering out of the kitchen in his pajamas. "What's that noise?"
Lavinia raced to her room, removed the chair, and opened her door. The thread had indeed formed a sphere. This new Baxter was huge, nearly half her height and as wide as the doorway, and it was mean. It rolled around Lavinia in a tight circle, growling and sniffing as if deciding whether or not to eat her. When her father came bounding upstairs, new Baxter leapt at him. Lavinia shot out her hand and managed to grab one of its threads, and using all her strength, she managed to hold the creature back. She yanked new Baxter into her room and slammed the door. Her heart hammered as she watched it eat her desk chair, discharging a pile of wood chips behind it in an excremental trail. Oh, this was bad. This was terrible. Not only was new Baxter like a rabid dog compared to old Baxter, it was made not from the dreams of an innocent child, but the nightmares of a rotten-souled murderer. But there was a killer on the loose, and thanks to her, he was now free of fear and inhibition. If he killed again, it would be at least partly her fault. She couldn't just throw new Baxter in a fire and be rid of it. She had to put it back from whence it had come, inside the young man's head. The idea frightened her. How would she find him? And when she did, what would stop him from killing her, too? She didn't know. All she knew was that she had to try. She pulled a fat handful of threads from new Baxter and wound them around her arm like a leash. Then she yanked it across the room and threw her open window. On the ground outside was a torn piece of the young man's shirt. She picked it up and gave it to new Baxter to sniff. "Dinner," she said. The result was instantaneous. New Baxter nearly pulled Lavinia's arm off, tugging her across the yard and then down the road by its leash. New Baxter chased the young man's scent trail for much of the day, leading Lavinia all through town in circles, then out the other side of it. They travelled down a rural road into the middle of nowhere. Finally, just as the sun was setting, they came upon a large, isolated building, Mrs. Hennepin's orphanage. Smoke was pouring from the lower floor windows. It was on fire. Lavinia heard screams from the other side of the building. She ran around the corner, pulling new Baxter after her. Five orphans were at an upper floor window, gasping for breath as smoke billowed around them. On the ground below stood the young man, laughing.
"What have you done?" Lavinia cried.
"This house of horrors is where I spent my formative years," he said. "Now I'm ridding the world of nightmares, just like you."
New Baxter strained toward the young man. "Go get him," Lavinia said, and dropped the leash. New Baxter spun across the ground toward the young man. But instead of eating him, it leapt into the young man's arms and licked his face.
"Hey there, old friend," the young man said, laughing. "I don't have time to play right now, but here, go fetch."
He picked up a stick and threw it. New Baxter chased it straight into the burning building. Moments later, there came an inhuman scream as New Baxter was consumed by flames. Defenseless now, Lavinia tried to run, but the young man caught her, knocked her to the ground, and wrapped his hands around her throat.
"You're going to die now," he said calmly. "I owe you a great deal for removing those awful nightmares from my head, but I can't have you plotting to kill me."
Lavinia struggled for breath. She could feel herself blacking out. Then something jerked inside her pants pocket. Old Baxter. She took him out and jammed him into the young man's ear. The young man pulled his hands away from Lavinia's throat and fumbled at his ear, but he was too late. Old Baxter had already wriggled inside his head. The young man stared into the distance,
as if reading something only he could see. Lavinia squirmed, but still could not get away from him. The young man looked down at her and smiled. A clown, a few giant spiders, and a boogeyman under the bed. He laughed. A child's dreams. How sweet! I shall enjoy these. And he resumed strangling her. She kneed the young man in the stomach, and for a moment he removed his hands from her throat. He then curled his hand into a fist, but before he could strike her, she said, "Baxter, heel!" And Baxter, old, faithful Baxter, exited the young man's head suddenly and violently, flying out of his ears, his eyes, and his mouth, along with a gout of thick red blood. He fell backward, gurgling, and Lavinia sat up. The children screamed for help. Gathering her courage, Lavinia got up and ran inside the house. She choked on the thick smoke. Mrs. Hennepin lay dead on the sitting-room floor, a pair of scissors jutting from her eye socket. The door to the stairway was blocked by a wardrobe, the young man's doing, surely.
"Baxter, help me! Push!"
With Baxter's aid, Lavinia was able to knock the wardrobe out of the way and open the door, and then she ran up the stairs, out of the worst of the fire and smoke. One by one, she carried the children from the house, covering their eyes as they passed Mrs. Hennepin. When they were all safe, she collapsed on the lawn, half dead from burns and smoke inhalation. She woke up days later in a hospital, her father and brother looking down at her.
"We're so proud of you," said her father. "You're a hero, Vinny."
They had a thousand questions for her. She could see it in their faces, but for now she would be spared answering them.
"You were thrashing and moaning in your sleep," said Douglas. "I think you were having a nightmare."
So she had been, and so she continued to for years afterward. She easily could have reached into her own head and taken them out, but she did not. Instead, Lavinia devoted herself to the study of the human mind, and against great odds went on to become one of the first female doctors of psychology in America. She found it a successful practice and helped many people, and though she often suspected nightmare thread was lurking in the ears of her patients, she never used her talent to get rid of it. There were, she had come to believe, better ways.
Editor's note. This story is unusual for a number of reasons, most prominently its ending. The pacing and visuals of its final act have a distinctly modern feel, and I suspect that's because it's been tinkered with in the not-too-distant past. I was able to find an older, alternate ending in which the nightmare thread Lavinia removes from the young man rises up to consume her, like a whole-body version of the stockings she knits early in the tale. Unable to peel off this wriggling second skin, she flees from society, having become a nightmare herself. It's tragic and unfair, and I can see why some latter-day tale-teller chose to invent a new, more empowering ending. Whichever ending you prefer, the moral remains more or less the same, and it, too, is unusual. It warns peculiar children that there are some talents that are simply too complex and dangerous to use, and are better left alone. In other words, being born with a certain ability does not mean we are obliged to use it, and, in rare cases, we are obliged not to. All in all, this makes for a rather disheartening lesson. What peculiar child, having suffered through the challenges of peculiarhood, wants to hear that her ability is more curse than blessing? I'm certain that's why my own headmistress only read this to the older children, and why it remains one of the more obscure, if fascinating, tales. Millard Nullings.
The Locust. There was once a hard-working immigrant from Norway named Edvard, who went to America to seek his fortune. This was back in the days when only the eastern third of America had been settled by Europeans.
Most of its western land still belonged to the peoples that had roamed it since the last ice age. The fertile plains in the middle were known as the frontier, a wild place of great opportunity and great risk, and this was where Edvard settled. He had sold everything he owned in Norway, and with that money had bought land and farming equipment in a place known then as the Dakota Territory, where many other new arrivals from Norway had also settled. He built a simple house and established a small farm, and after a few years of hard work, even prospered a little. People in town told him he should find a wife and start a family.
"You're a strapping young lad," they said. "It's the natural order of things."
But Edvard resisted marrying. He loved his farm so much that he wasn't sure he had room in his heart to love a wife, too. He'd always felt love was impractical, that it got in the way of more important things. As a young man in Norway, Edvard had watched his best mate throw away what could have been a life of adventure and fortune when he fell in love with a girl who couldn't bear to leave her family in Norway. There was no money to be made in the old country, and now his old friend had a wife and children he could barely feed, sentenced to a life of compromise and deprivation, all thanks to a whim of his youthful heart. And yet, as fate would have it, even Edvard met a girl he took a fancy to. He found room in his heart to love both his farm and a wife, and he married her. He thought he could not possibly be happier, that his tough little heart was now full to bursting. So when his wife asked him to give her a child, he resisted. How could he possibly love a farm, a wife, and a child? And yet, when Edvard's wife became pregnant, he was surprised by the joy that filled him, and looked forward to the birth with tremendous anticipation. 9 months later, they welcomed a baby boy into the world. It was a difficult birth that left Edvard's wife weak and ailing. There was something wrong with the baby, too. Its heart was so big that one side of its chest was noticeably larger than the other.
"Will he live?" Edvard asked the doctor.
"Time will tell," the doctor replied. Unsatisfied, Edvard took his child to see old Eric, a healer who'd made a reputation for himself in the old country as an uncommonly wise man. He put his hands on the boy, and within moments his eyebrows shot up.
"This boy is peculiar," Eric exclaimed.
"So the doctor told me," said Edvard. "His heart is too large."
"It's more than just that," said Eric. "Though precisely what's special about him may not manifest itself for years."
"But will he live?" asked Edvard.
"Time will tell," Eric replied.
Edvard's son did live, but his wife only grew weaker, and finally she died. At first, Edvard was devastated, and then he grew angry. He was angry with himself for allowing love to disrupt his plans for a practical life. Now he had a farm to work and an infant to care for, and no wife to help him. He was angry, too, at the child, for being strange and special and delicate, but especially for sending his wife to the grave on his way into the world. He knew this was not the child's fault, of course, and that being angry at an infant made no sense, but he couldn't help it. All the love he had unwisely allowed to blossom inside him had turned to bitterness, and now that it was there, lodged in him like a gallstone, he didn't know how to get rid of it. He named the boy Ollie, and raised him alone. He sent Ollie to school, where he learned English and other subjects Edvard knew little about. In some ways, the boy was recognizably his son. He looked like Edvard, and worked just as hard, tilling and ploughing beside his father every hour that he wasn't at school or asleep, and never complaining. But in other ways, the boy was a stranger. He spoke Norwegian with a flat American accent. He seemed to believe that the world had good things in store for him, a peculiarly American idea. Worst of all, the boy was enslaved to the whims of his too large heart. He fell in love in an instant. By the age of 7, he had proposed marriage to a classmate, a neighbor girl,
and the young woman who played the organ at church, 15 years his senior. If ever a bird should fall from the sky, Ollie would sniffle and cry over it for days. When he realized that the meat on his dinner plate came from animals, he refused to eat it ever again. The boy's insides were made of goo. The real trouble with Ollie started when he was 14, the year the locusts came. No one in Dakota had seen anything like it before. Swarms big enough to blot out the sun, miles wide, like a curse from God. People could not walk outdoors without crushing insects under their feet by the hundreds. The locusts ate everything green they could find, and when they ran out of grass, they moved on to corn and wheat. And when that was gone, they devoured wood and fiber and leather and roofs made of sod. They would strip the wool from sheep in the fields. One poor soul was caught in a swarm of them and had the clothes eaten off his back. It was a scourge that threatened to destroy the livelihood of every settler on the frontier, Edvard's included, and the settlers tried everything they could think of to combat it. They used fire and smoke and poison to try to drive the bugs away. They pushed heavy stone rollers over the ground to squash them. The town near Edvard's farm mandated that every person over the age of 10 deliver 30 pounds of dead locusts to the dump every week or be fined. Edvard threw himself into the task enthusiastically. But his son refused to kill a single locust. When Ollie walked outdoors, he even shuffled his feet so as not to accidentally squash one. It nearly drove his father to distraction. "They've eaten all our crops!" Edvard shouted at him. "They're ruining our farm!" "They're just hungry," his son replied. "They're not hurting us on purpose, so it isn't fair to hurt them on purpose." "Fairness doesn't enter into it," Edvard said, straining to control his temper. "Sometimes in life you have to kill in order to survive."
"Not in this case," said Ollie. "Killing them hasn't done any good at all."
By this point, Edvard had gone completely red in the face.
"Smash that locust," he demanded, pointing at one on the ground.
"I will not," Ollie said.
Edvard was livid. He slapped his disobedient son, and still he refused to kill them, so Edvard thrashed him with his belt and sent the boy to his room without supper. As he listened to Ollie crying through the wall, he stared out the window at a haze of locusts rising from his ruined fields and felt his heart hardening against his son. Word spread among the settlers that Ollie had refused to kill locusts, and people got angry. The town fined his father. Ollie's classmates pinned him down and tried to make him eat one. People Ollie hardly knew hurled insults at him on the street. His father was so angry and embarrassed that he stopped speaking to his son. Suddenly, Ollie found himself with no friends and no one to talk to, and he became so lonely that one day he adopted a pet. It was the only living creature who would tolerate his presence. A locust. He named it Thor, after the old Norse god, and kept it hidden under his bed in a cigar box. He fed it dinner scraps and sugar water, and talked to it late at night when he was supposed to be sleeping.
"It's not your fault everyone hates you," he whispered to Thor. "You were just doing what you were made to do."
"Chirp, chirp," replied the locust, rubbing its wings together.
"Shh, shh, 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 shh,"
Ollie said, and he slipped a few grains of rice into the box and closed it. Ollie began to carry Thor with him everywhere he went. He grew very fond of the little insect, who perched on his shoulder and chirped when the sun shone and would hop about merrily when Ollie whistled a tune. Then one day his father discovered Thor's box. Enraged, he snatched the locust out, took it to the hearth, and threw it into the flames. There was a high-pitched whine and a quiet pop, and Thor was gone. When Ollie cried for his dead friend, Edvard kicked him out.
"No one sheds tears for a locust in my house," he shouted, and pushed his son outside.
Ollie spent the night shivering in the fields. The next morning, his father felt bad for being so harsh and went outside to find the boy, but instead he came upon a giant locust sleeping between rows of ruined wheat. Edvard recoiled in disgust. The creature was as big as a mastiff, with thighs like Christmas hams, and antennae as long as riding crops. Edvard ran into the house to fetch his gun, but when he came back to shoot the thing, locusts swarmed around him and flew into the barrel of his rifle, clogging it. Then they swirled in the air before him and divided themselves into letters that spelled a word. O-L-L-I-E. Edvard dropped his gun in shock and stared at the giant locust, which was now standing on its hind legs as a human would. It didn't have black eyes like locusts do, but blue ones, like Ollie's.
No, Edvard said. It's not possible.
But then he noticed that the torn collar of his son's shirt was around the creature's neck, and a cuff of Ollie's pants was attached to its leg.
Ollie, he said, tentatively, is that you?
In what seemed to be a nod, the bug moved its head up and down. Edvard's skin prickled strangely. He felt as if he were watching the scene from outside his body. His son had turned into a locust.
"Can you speak?"
Edvard asked. Ollie rubbed his hind legs together and made a high-pitched noise, but it seemed that was the best he could do. Edvard didn't know how to react. He was disgusted by the very sight of Ollie, but still, something had to be done for the boy. He didn't want everyone finding out, though, so rather than call the town doctor, who had a big mouth, he sent for wise old Eric. Eric came hobbling out into the field to have a look. After his initial shock, he said, "It's just as I predicted. It took years, but he's finally manifesting his peculiar trait." "Yes, obviously," said Edvard. "But why? And how can it be reversed?" Eric consulted a tattered old book that he'd brought with him, a folk manual of peculiar conditions which had passed down through generations of his family from a great-grandmother who had herself been peculiar. "Ah, here we go," he said, licking his thumb to turn a page. "It says that when a person with a certain peculiar temperament and a large and generous heart no longer feels loved by his own kind, he'll take on the form of whatever creature he feels most connected to." Eric gave Edvard a strange look that made Edvard feel ashamed. "The boy had a locust friend?"
"A pet, yes," said Edvard. "I threw it into the fire."
Eric clicked his tongue and shook his head.
"Perhaps you were a bit hard on him."
"He's too soft for this world," Edvard grumbled, "but never mind. How do we fix him?"
"I don't need a book to tell me that,"
Eric said, closing the tattered volume.
"You have to love him,
Edvard."
Eric wished him good luck and left Edvard alone with the creature that was once his son. He stared at its long, papery wings and its awful mandibles, and he shuddered. How could he love such a thing? Still, he made an attempt, but he was filled with resentment, and his efforts were not sincere. Instead of showing the boy kindness, Edvard spent all day lecturing him.
"Don't I love you, boy? Don't I feed you and give you a roof to sleep under? I had to give up school and go to work at the age of 8, but don't I let you bury your head in books and schoolwork to your heart's content? What do you call that, if not love? What more do I owe you, you entitled American brat?"
And so on. When night fell, Edvard couldn't bear to let Ollie into the house, so he made him a place to sleep in the barn and left a few table scraps in a pail for him to eat. Toughness makes a man, Edvard believed, and being soft on Ollie now would only encourage more of the weak-hearted behavior that had turned him into a locust in the first place. In the morning, his son was gone.
Edvard searched every inch of the barn and every row of his fields, but the boy was nowhere to be found. When he hadn't returned after 3 days, Edvard began to wonder if he'd taken the wrong approach with Ollie. He had stuck to his principles, but for what? He had driven away his only son. Now that Ollie was gone, Edvard realized how little his farm meant to him by comparison. But it was a lesson learned too late. Edvard became so sad and sorry that he went into town and admitted to everyone what had happened.
"I turned my son into a locust," he said, "and now I've lost everything."
No one believed him at first, so he asked old Eric to corroborate his story.
"It's true," Eric said to anyone who asked. "His son is an enormous locust. He's the size of a dog."
Edvard made the townspeople an offer.
"My heart is like an old shriveled apple," he said. "I can't help my son, but if anyone can love him enough to turn him back into a boy, I'll give you my farm."
This excited the townspeople tremendously. For such a rich prize, they said, they could make themselves love nearly anything. Of course, first they had to find the locust boy. So they set out in search parties and began to comb the roads and fields. Ollie, who had super-sensitive locust ears, heard everything. He'd heard his father talking about him. He heard the footsteps of the people searching for him, and he wanted no part of it. He hid in the field of a neighboring farm with his new locust friends, and any time someone came near, the locusts would swarm up and surround the person, creating a wall that gave Ollie time to escape. But a few days later, the locusts ran out of food and took to the sky to migrate elsewhere. Ollie tried to join them, but he was too big and too heavy to fly. Being unsentimental creatures, not a single locust stayed behind to keep Ollie company, and he was left alone again. Without his friends to help protect him, it wasn't long before a group of boys was able to sneak up on Ollie while he was sleeping and capture him in a net. They were the same boys who had tormented Ollie at school. The oldest one slung Ollie over his shoulder as they skipped back to town, singing and celebrating.
"We're going to turn him back into a boy, and then we'll get Edvard's whole farm," they cheered. "We'll be rich."
They kept Ollie in a cage in their house and waited. When, after a week, he stubbornly remained a locust, they switched tactics.
"Tell it you love it," the boy's mother suggested.
"I love you,"
the youngest boy shouted through the bars of Ollie's cage, but he could hardly get the words out before he started laughing.
"At least keep a straight face when you say it," the older boy said. Then he gave it a try. "I love you, locust."
But Ollie wasn't paying attention. He had curled up in a corner and gone to sleep.
"Hey, I'm talking to you,"
the boy shouted, and kicked the cage.
"I love you!"
But he did not, nor could he force himself to. And when Ollie began making locust shrieks all night, the family gave up and sold Ollie to their neighbor. He was an old hunter with no family and little experience in matters of the heart, and after a few feeble attempts to show the boy love, he abandoned the effort and sent Ollie outside to live with the hunting dogs. Ollie much preferred the dog's company to the man's. He ate with them and slept alongside them in their doghouse, and though they were afraid of him at first, Ollie was so gentle and kind that they soon grew accustomed to him, and he became one of the pack. In fact, he felt so accepted by them that one day the hunter found he was missing a giant locust, but had gained an extra-large dog. The months Ollie spent as a dog were some of the happiest of his life. But then came hunting season, when the dogs were expected to work. On the first day, the hunter brought the pack out to a field of tall grass. He shouted a command, and all the dogs began to run, barking, through the field. Ollie followed along, barking and making a fuss. It was good fun. Then, suddenly, he tripped over a goose in the grass. The goose leapt into the air and started to fly away, but before it could get anywhere, there was a loud crack, and it fell back to earth, dead. Ollie stared at its body in horror.
A moment later, another dog trotted up to him and said,
"What are you waiting for? Aren't you going to take it back to master?"
"Of course not," Ollie said.
"Suit yourself," said the dog, "but if master finds out, he'll shoot you."
And then he grasped the dead goose in his jaws and trotted away. The next morning, Ollie was gone. He'd run away with the geese, chasing their V-shaped migration from the ground. When Edvard heard that his son had been found and then lost again, he sank into a despair from which those who knew him worried he'd never emerge. He stopped leaving his house. He let all his fields lie fallow. If old Eric had not brought him food once a week, he may well have starved. But like the locust plague, Edvard's time of darkness eventually passed, and he began to tend his farm again and to turn up at the market in town and in his old pew in church on Sundays. And after a time he fell in love again and married, and he and his wife had a child, a girl they called Asgard. Edvard was determined to love Asgard, as he had failed to love Ollie, and as she grew up he did his best to keep his heart open. He let her love stray animals and cry over silly things, and he never scolded her for acting out of kindness. When she was 8 years old, Edvard had a hard season. The crops failed, and they had only turnips to eat. Then one day a flock of geese was passing overhead, and one of them left the formation and landed near Edvard's house. It was very large, nearly twice the size of a normal goose, and because it didn't seem afraid, Edvard was able to walk right up to it and grab it.
"You'll make a good dinner tonight,"
Edvard said, and he carried the goose inside and locked it in a cage. It had been weeks since they'd had meat on their dinner table, and Edvard's wife was excited. She stoked a fire and prepared the cooking pot while Edvard sharpened his carving knife. But when Asgard came into the kitchen and saw what was happening, she became upset.
"You can't kill it," she cried. "It's a nice goose, and it didn't do anything to us. It isn't fair."
"Fairness doesn't enter into it," Edvard told her. "In life, sometimes you have to kill in order to survive."
"But we don't have to kill it," she said. "We can eat turnip soup again tonight. I don't mind."
And then she collapsed in front of the goose's cage and began to weep. At another time in Edvard's life, he might have scolded his daughter and lectured her about the perils of soft-heartedness. But now he remembered his son.
"Oh, all right. We won't kill it," he said, kneeling down to comfort her.
Asgard stopped crying. "Thank you, Papa. May we keep it?"
"Only if it wants to stay," said Edvard. "It's a wild thing, so keeping it in a cage would be cruel."
He opened the cage. The goose waddled out, and Asgard threw her arms around its neck.
"I love you, Mr. Goose."
"Wah!"
the goose replied. That night they ate turnip soup and went to bed with their stomachs grumbling, happy as could be. The goose became Asgard's beloved pet. It slept in the barn, followed Asgard to school every morning, and sat honking on the schoolhouse roof all day while she was inside. She let everyone know the goose was her best friend, and that no one was allowed to shoot it or make it into soup, and they let it be. Asgard made up fantastic stories about adventures she had with her goose, like the time she rode goose to the moon so they could see what moon cheese tasted like, and she regaled her parents with these tales at dinner time. That's why they weren't terribly surprised when Asgard woke them up one morning in a state of excitement and announced that Goose had turned into a young man.
"Go back to sleep," Edvard said, yawning. "Even the rooster isn't awake yet."
"I'm serious," Asgard cried. "Come and see for yourself."
And she tugged her tired father out of bed by his arm. Edvard nearly fainted when he got inside the barn. There, standing in a nest of straw, was his long-lost son. Ollie was grown now, 6 feet tall, with strong features and a stubbled chin. He wore a burlap sack around his waist that he'd found on the floor of the barn.
"See, I wasn't lying,"
Asgard said, and she ran to Ollie and hugged him hard.
What are you doing, silly goose?
Ollie broke into a big smile. Hello, father, he said. Did you miss me?
Very much, said Edward.
His heart hurt so much that he began to cry, and he went to his son and hugged him.
I hope you can forgive me,
he whispered. I did years ago, Ollie replied. It just took some time to find my way back.
Father, said Asgard, what's happening?
Edward let Ollie go, wiped his tears, and turned to his daughter.
This is your older brother, he said. The one I told you about.
Who turned into a bug?
She said, eyes growing wide.
And ran away?
The same, Ollie said, and put out his hand for Asgard to shake. Pleased to meet you. I'm Ollie.
No, she said, you're Goose.
And she ignored Ollie's extended hand and hugged him again.
How'd you become a goose, anyway?
Ollie hugged his sister back. It's rather a long story, he said.
Good, said Asgard. I love stories.
He'll tell us over breakfast, said Edward. Won't you, son?
Ollie grinned.
I'd love to.
Edward took him by one hand and Asgard by the other, and they led him into the house. After Edward's wife had recovered from the shock, they sat together and ate a breakfast of turnips on toast, while Ollie told them all about his years as a goose. From that day forward, he was a member of the family. Edward loved his son unconditionally, and never again did Ollie lose his human form. And they lived happily ever after. The Boy Who Could Hold Back the Sea. There was once a peculiar young man named Fergus who could harness the power of the currents and tides. This was in Ireland during its terrible famine. He might have used his talent to catch fish to eat, but he lived in a landlocked place far from the sea, and his power was of no use in rivers or lakes. He might have set off for the coast. He'd been there once as a young boy. That's how he knew what he could do. But his mother was too weak to travel, and Fergus couldn't leave her alone. He was all the family she had left. Fergus gave her every bit of food he could scrounge while he survived on sawdust and boiled shoe leather. But it was sickness that finally got her, not hunger. And in the end, there was nothing to be done. As she lay dying, his mother made him promise to leave for the coast as soon as she was in the ground.
With your talent, you'll be the best fisherman who ever lived, and you'll never have to go hungry again. But never tell anyone what you can do, son, or people will make your life hell.
He promised he would do as she said, and the next day she died. Fergus buried her in the churchyard, threw his few possessions into a sack, and began his long walk to the sea. He walked for 6 days with one shoe and no food. He was starving, and all the people in the towns he passed along the way were starving too. Some towns had been abandoned altogether, the farmers gone to seek better fortunes and fuller stomachs in America. Finally he reached the seaside, and a little town called Skellygeen, where none of the houses looked empty and none of the people looked hungry. This he took as a sign that he'd come to the right place. If the people of Skellygeen were still around and well fed, the fishing must be very good, which was a lucky thing, because he didn't think he could go much longer without eating. He asked a man where he might find a fishing pole or a net, but the man told him he wouldn't find any such thing in Skellygeen.
"We don't fish here," the man said.
He seemed oddly proud of it, as if being a fisherman were something shameful.
"If you don't fish," Fergus said, "then how do you live?"
Fergus hadn't noticed any signs of industry in his ramble around the town. No pens of livestock, no crops other than the same rotting potatoes he saw everywhere in Ireland.
"Our business is salvage,"
the man replied, and did not elaborate. Fergus asked the man if he had anything to eat.
"I'll work for it," he offered.
"What work could you possibly do?" the man said, looking the boy up and down. "I could use someone who could lift heavy boxes, but you're scrawny as a bird. I'll bet you don't weigh 70 pounds. "I may not be able to lift heavy boxes, but I can do something no one else can."
"And what's that?" said the man.
Fergus was about to tell him when he remembered the promise he'd made to his mother, and he muttered something vague and scurried away. He decided to make a fishing line from the lace of his shoe and try to catch something. He stopped a plump-looking lady and asked her where he might find a good fishing spot.
"You needn't bother," the lady said. "All you'll catch from shore are poisonous puffer fish."
Fergus tried anyway, using a bit of stale bread for bait. He fished all day, but caught nothing. Not even a poisonous puffer fish. Desperate, his stomach in terrible pain, he asked a man walking along the beach if someone might have a boat he could borrow.
"Then I could go a bit farther out to sea," said Fergus, "where perhaps the fish are more plentiful."
"You'll never make it," the man said. "The current will dash you to bits on the rocks."
"Not me," Fergus said.
The man looked at him skeptically, about to turn his back. Fergus really didn't want to break his promise, but it was beginning to look like he'd starve to death unless he told someone about his talent. So he said,
"I can control the current."
"Ha!" the man replied. "I've heard some whoppers in my time, but that tops them all."
"If I can prove it, will you give me something to eat?"
"Sure," the man said, amused. "I'll throw you a banquet." So the man and Fergus went down to the shoreline, where the tide was going out for the day. Fergus huffed and grunted and gritted his teeth, and with a great deal of effort he was able to bring the tide back in, the water rising from their ankles up to their knees in just a few minutes. The man was astounded and very excited by what he'd seen. He brought Fergus back to his house and threw him a lavish banquet, just as he'd promised. He invited all his neighbours, and while Fergus stuffed himself, his host told the townspeople how Fergus had brought in the tide. They were very excited, strangely excited, almost too excited. They began to crowd around him.
"Show us your tide-pulling trick!"
a woman shouted at him.
"The boy needs his strength," the host said. "Let him eat first."
When Fergus couldn't force himself to take another bite, he looked up from his plate and around the room. Stacked in every corner were crates and boxes, each filled to the top with different things, bottles of wine in one box, dried spices in another, rolls of fabric in another. To one side of Fergus's chair was a crate, spilling over with dozens and dozens of hammers.
"Excuse me, but why do you need so many hammers?" Fergus asked.
"I'm in the salvage business," the man explained. "I found them washed up on the beach one morning."
"And the wine and rolls of fabric and dried spices," Fergus said.
"Those two," the man replied. "Guess I'm just lucky."
The other guests found this funny for some reason and laughed. Fergus began to feel uncomfortable, and thanking his host for the fine meal, excused himself to go.
"But he can't leave without showing us his trick," said one of the guests. "It's late. He must be tired," said the host. "Let the boy sleep first."
Fergus was tired, and the offer of a bed was more than he could resist. The man showed him to a cozy bedroom, and the moment Fergus's head hit the pillow, he fell into a deep sleep. In the middle of the night, he snapped suddenly awake to find people in his room. They crowded around the bed and tore his blankets off.
"You've slept enough," they said. "It's time to do your trick."
Fergus realized he'd made a mistake, and he should have snuck out the bedroom window and run away, or better yet, never revealed his talent in the first place. But it was too late for that now. The crowd dragged him out of bed and down to the shore, where they demanded he pull in the tide again. Fergus didn't like being forced to do things, but the more he resisted, the angrier they got. They weren't going to let him go until he did what they asked. And so, resolving to run away at the first opportunity, he pulled in the tide. Water came rushing in. The people jumped and cheered.
A bell began tolling out to sea. A bank of fog cleared, revealing the lights of a passing ship, which was being dragged toward land by the quickly shifting tide. When Fergus realized what was happening, he tried to push the tide back out again, but it was too late, and he watched in horror as the ship smashed to pieces against a cape of jagged rocks. Dawn began to break. The ship's cargo washed ashore in crates and boxes, along with the bodies of the drowned crew. The townspeople divided the crates among them and started carrying them off. This is what they'd meant by salvage. They were wreckers, and drew passing ships towards the rocks with false lights and signals. They were thieves and murderers, and they had tricked Fergus into doing their evil work for them. Fergus broke free from them and tried to run, but a crowd blocked his escape.
"You're not going anywhere," they said. "There's another merchant ship passing tonight, and you're going to help us wreck that one too." "I'd rather die," Fergus shouted, and then he ran in a direction none of them had expected, toward the water.
He splashed into the surf, grabbed a splintered plank from the wreckage, and began to paddle. The wreckers tried to catch him, but Fergus used his talent to make a wave that rolled in reverse, pushing him away from shore rather than toward it, and soon he was far beyond their grasp.
"Idiot!"
they shouted after him.
"You'll drown!"
But he didn't drown. He hung onto the plank for dear life, the wave carrying him past the rocks and far out to sea into the deep, cold water where ships passed. He waited, bobbing and shivering for hours until a ship appeared on the horizon. Then he made another wave and rowed it toward the ship. When he got close, he began to shout. The ship was very tall, and he was afraid no one would notice him, but finally someone did. A rope was lowered, and Fergus was brought up onto the deck. The ship was called the Hannah, and it was filled with people who were emigrating to America to escape Ireland's famine. They had sold everything they owned to buy their passage, and now they had nothing but their lives and the clothes on their backs. The captain was a cruel, greedy man named Shaw, and no sooner had Fergus been pulled from the ocean than Captain Shaw wanted to throw him back again.
"We don't allow stowaways on this ship," he said, "paying passengers only."
"But I'm not a stowaway," Fergus pleaded. "I'm a rescue."
"I say who's what around here," the captain growled, "and all I know is you haven't paid for a ticket."
"I'll work for my passage," Fergus pleaded. "Please don't throw me back."
"Work?" the captain said, laughing. "You got arms like noodles and little chicken legs. What work could you possibly do?"
Though Fergus knew his facility with tides and currents could be of great help to a ship captain, he had learned his lesson back in Skellygeen and kept his mouth shut about it. Instead, he said,
"I can work harder than any man here, and you'll never hear me complain, no matter what you make me do."
"Is that so?" said the captain. "We'll see about that. Someone fetch the boy a scrub brush."
The captain turned Fergus into his personal slave. Every day, Fergus was forced to clean the captain's quarters, iron his clothes, shine his shoes, and bring him his meals. And when he was done with those things, he scrubbed the decks and emptied latrine buckets, which were heavy, and sloshed onto his feet as he dumped them overboard. Fergus did more work than anyone else on the ship, but true to his word, he never complained. The work didn't bother him, but the problem of the ship's food supply did. The captain had taken on too many passengers and not enough provisions, and though Captain Shaw and his crew ate like kings, Fergus and the passengers were forced to subsist on crusts of stale bread and cups of broth that contained more mouse droppings than meat. Even those nearly inedible rations were in short supply. However fast the Hannah sailed, there was hardly enough to last the voyage. The weather grew unseasonably cold. One morning it began to snow, even though it was late spring. One of the passengers pointed out that the sun was not where it should be for a voyage headed west, toward America. Instead, they seemed to be sailing north. A group of passengers confronted the captain.
"Where are we?" they said. "Is this really the way to America?"
It's a shortcut, the captain assured them. We'll be there in no time. That afternoon, Fergus saw icebergs floating in the distance. He was beginning to suspect they'd been duped. So that evening, he listened outside the captain's door while pretending to scrub the hallway.
"Just another day or two and we should reach Pent Island," he heard the captain say to his first mate. "We'll pick up a cargo of furs, deliver it to New York, and that alone should double our profits for the voyage."
Fergus was furious. They weren't taking a shortcut to America at all. They were purposely veering off course, making the journey longer and almost guaranteeing the passengers would starve before they reached port. Before Fergus could slip away, the captain's door flew open. He was caught.
"He's been spying!" the captain cried. "What did you hear?"
"Every last word," Fergus said. "And when I tell the passengers what you've done, they're going to throw you overboard." The captain and first mate drew their cutlasses. But just as they were closing in on him, there was a terrible crash and what felt like an earthquake, and they were all thrown to the floor. The captain and the first mate picked themselves up and rushed from the room, Fergus and his threat forgotten. The Hannah had struck an iceberg, and it was sinking fast. There was only one lifeboat, and before the passengers knew what was happening, Captain Shaw and his cowardly men had commandeered it for themselves. Desperate mothers cried out for the captain to take their children aboard, but pistols in hand, his men threatened anyone who came near their lifeboat. And then the captain and his men were gone, and there were no more lifeboats, and Fergus and the passengers were alone on a sinking ship in the middle of an icy sea. The moon was high and bright, and in its light Fergus could see the iceberg they had hit. It wasn't far away, and it looked wide and flat enough to stand on. The ship was listing badly to one side, but hadn't yet sunk, so Fergus summoned a current and pushed the broken Hannah until its side bumped against the iceberg's edge. The passengers helped one another onto the ice, the last of them leaving the ship just before it sank beneath the waves. They cheered and rejoiced, but their voices were drowned out as a wintry wind began to howl. It seemed they had traded a quick death by drowning for a protracted one by cold and starvation. They spent the night shivering on the ice, huddled together for a little warmth. In the morning, they woke to find a polar bear lurking close by. It was thin and wretched-looking. The people and the bear watched one another nervously, and then, after a few hours, the bear stood up and walked to the edge of the iceberg. He seemed to have heard something, and when Fergus followed him at a careful distance, he saw a big school of fish churning the water a few hundred yards away. There were thousands of them, more than enough to feed everyone, if only they could be reached. The bear flopped into the water and swam out toward the fish. He was too weak to reach it, though, and soon clambered back onto the iceberg, miserable and exhausted. Fergus knew what he had to do, even if it meant breaking the promise he'd made to his mother yet again. He raised his arms, clenched his fists, and made a current that directed the fish right toward their iceberg. Soon fish by the hundreds were banging against it and flopping up onto the ice. The bear roared with excitement, vacuumed several into his mouth, then scooped up a paw load and ran off. The people were overjoyed. Though they didn't care for the taste of raw fish, it was better than starving. Fergus had saved them. They lifted him above their heads, chanting his name, then ate until they could eat no more. As it turned out, Fergus hadn't quite saved them. Though they now had enough fish to last them weeks, that afternoon the temperature dropped and a blizzard blew in. As they huddled together for warmth, full but freezing, they realized that without blankets they would not live to see the morning. It was just turning dark when they heard a growl from outside their circle. The bear had returned.
"What do you want?" Fergus said, leaping up to confront it. "You've got all the fish you can eat, so leave us alone."
But the bear's attitude had changed. He didn't seem desperate or dangerous now, as he had when he was starving.
In fact, he seemed grateful, and he seemed to understand that Fergus and the others were in trouble. The bear padded forward, lay down next to them, and went to sleep.